the risks of waiting until you're at the brink of death, even if you don't die, will have consequences to your life and future fertility and organs. It's not harmless to wait until the brink of death to intervene. And in emergency medicine, we've always known that.
Hi there, and welcome to Amicus. This is Slate's podcast about all things legal and judicial and Supreme Courtish. I am Dahlia Lithwick. I cover the courts and the law for Slate. On Tuesday of this past week, the Supreme Court of the great state of Arizona brought back an 1864 anti-abortion statute that contains no exceptions for rape or incest or maternal health, and it did so under the theory that after Dobbs, every single day is the 1860s again for women in America. And so, in 2 weeks' time, presumably, unless this is repaired, any physician performing any abortion in Arizona that isn't done to save the life of the pregnant person will face between 2 to 5 years in jail. Not a joke, not a drill. We are going to be turning our attention on this week's show to the next big abortion case to be argued at the Supreme Court. It is EMTALA time, folks, a dispute over whether states can decline to abide by the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. EMTALA is a federal law that requires providing stabilizing care for all emergency room patients, including abortion care, even if that care conflicts with a state's own narrower abortion rules. So we're going to be talking to ER physician Dr. Dara Kass, who's going to help us think about what doctors think about when they are tasked with providing emergency care. In other news, the law of Trump beat continues to ramp up, with a whole bunch of litigation happening, first of all, in Judge Eileen Cannon's courtroom in Florida, and also in New York City, where Donald Trump ostensibly goes to trial for campaign finance distortions starting this Monday. Our intrepid Law of Trump trademark correspondent, Jeremy Stahl, is headed to New York as we are taping, and we will, of course, be getting updates from him as things get underway starting next week. Later on in this episode of Amicus, I'm going to be joined by Slate's very own Mark Joseph Stern, who's going to take off his members-only jacket and join us on the main show for a conversation about a weird new intramural debate that has sprung up on the op-ed pages urging Justice Sonia Sotomayor to retire immediately. Now, honestly, Mark and I are kind of reluctant participants in this conversation, but we recognize it's probably overdue for reasons both systemic and stakes-based. You are going to want to stick around to the very end of that conversation because Mark and I have a special announcement coming your way about big plans that we have for May and how you, our dear listeners, can be a part of them. I'm talking especially to you, our esteemed Slate Plus listeners. And speaking of, hey, Slate Plusers, you sweethearts, you darlings, y'all signed up bigly last week for our new separate standalone Slate Plus bonus conversation with Mark and I. I know that it's because Mark Joseph Stern's musings about Clarence Thomas's clerks are always liquid gold, but I just want to thank you so much for supporting the work we do here at the magazine. So this week in our separate members-only Amicus bonus episode, Mark and I are going to review that great big abortion decision that came out of Arizona. But first, in a week and a half, the Supreme Court will hear arguments in Moyle v. United States. The issue is actually fairly simple. A federal law, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, or EMTALA, requires all hospitals that receive federal Medicare funding, which means virtually every hospital, to provide, quote, such treatment as may be required to stabilize the medical condition, end quote, of any individual who arrives in an ER with an emergency medical condition. Now, this law was broadly understood to cover, and the Biden administration in 2022, post-Dobbs, clarified that it did indeed cover the need to perform stabilizing abortion care on patients for whom it is the medically indicated treatment to resolve an emergency. The state of Idaho's anti-abortion law allows for an abortion only when necessary to prevent the death of the pregnant woman, but not when it might merely cause disability or serious bodily harm. The Biden administration sued Idaho, alleging that the state's abortion ban conflicts with EMTALA and that federal law trumps Idaho law. This is basic supremacy clause 101. When a federal law conflicts with a state law, the federal law preempts the state law. Idaho says, nope, not in this case. They contend that this state law should absolutely trump the federal law. But as I mentioned, preemption doctrine says that in a foot race between state and federal law wins. It wins every time. Does that sound ridiculously simple? That's because it is. And yet, when a federal district court ruled in 2022 that Idaho's abortion ban cannot possibly trump EMTALA if a pregnant patient has a medical emergency requiring an abortion, the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and put that order on hold. If the mifepristone arguments hadn't used up all of journalism's abortion ink a few weeks back, we would be thinking of this lawsuit as one of the most important ones of the term. And as we heard in the Miffy case, sometimes discussions of the potential consequences and harms of these post-Dobbs cases sort of skip over the how does healthcare actually work piece of the puzzle. So we decided to invite an ER physician to help us understand what EMTALA was designed to do and what ER physicians are being asked to do and what happens to real healthcare for real people if Idaho prevails in this case. Dr. Dara Kass is an emergency medicine physician in New York. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times and the Washington Post, as well as in Slate, and in numerous publications for healthcare professionals. Until very, very recently, she served as a regional director at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services based in New York City. Dr. Dara Kass, welcome to the podcast.
It is my actual huge pleasure to be here with you, Dahlia. Thank you.
Can you just, to set the table, because we don't have nearly enough ER doctors on this show, can you just tell us what an ER physician does all day? Is it like the TV shows where you like run around and there's like gurneys and bleeding? Or what is your life like?
Emergency medicine has evolved since even I trained starting 20 years ago into really being the place that people come to, you know, for all reasons, right? Yes, of course, heart attack, stroke, gunshot wounds, emergencies as we think of them, but also when they can't get care that they need for a problem that they have right in front of them, or they need to double check they're taking a medication and I think they're having a medication reaction, right? Emergency medicine is, you know, anyone, anytime, we're the jack of all trades. We take care of a whole, like any patient to start and then often hand them off to somebody else. It's a remarkable job. It is my honor and privilege to be an emergency medicine doctor. I was in the federal government, like you said, for a while. I just left. And one of the reasons I left was I missed being in the ER and truly having the privilege to take care of people on what could be the worst day of their life, but a day where I can hopefully make it a little bit better.
And can you just tell us what proportion of the cases you would see on an average day are pregnancy complications? It's a huge, huge part of your job, right? I think I read a study that said that pregnancy complications are the fifth most common reason for ER visits for women between the ages of 15 and 64.
It's a very common reason, and it can be from things like, I think I'm pregnant and I'm not sure, to I was pregnant or I am pregnant and I'm bleeding, to I'm actually in labor, right? So pregnancy complications can be the whole spectrum. You know, at least 1 million patients come to the emergency department for things like concerns about pregnancy loss, right? I'm worried I'm having a miscarriage. It's a large number of patients that we see. I would say I personally work in the area of the ER that tends to see the patients who are pregnant. And I would say I see somebody every single shift who is pregnant with a concern related to their pregnancy.
And can you just back up and remind us when EMTALA was enacted by the Congress in 1986, so suddenly it requires that hospitals around the country have to guarantee that all patients get a certain standard of care. It's guaranteeing that patients are not, I think the word was dumped, right? Whether it's like dumped in the parking lot or dumped in some other ER parking lot. What was the concern they were trying to address?
So this is really important. And I think it goes to the tone of what we're talking about with Moyle, which is that EMTALA was passed in 1986 as an anti-dumping law. What was happening was patients were presenting to private hospitals with an emergency, but before that emergency was even evaluated, they were evaluated for the ability to pay, whether they were insured, whether their emergency itself would be more expensive than the reimbursement that the facility would have gotten. And for some patients, often poor, often patients of color, often patients of trauma, they would literally be removed from the private hospital and pushed towards the public hospital, sometimes as ridiculous, if you will, as being put on a stretcher and rolled down the block, because often public and private hospitals are across the street from each other. And that was a practice that was causing people to die en route. Literally, they would be bleeding out at the private hospital. They would be continuing to bleed like as they would be pushed to the public hospital, and they would come to the public hospital in death or near death. And so in 1986, the federal government stepped in and they said, before you transfer a patient from one facility to another, you have to evaluate them regardless of their ability to pay. You have to stabilize them. And then if you're going to transfer them, it has to be appropriate. You have to put them in an ambulance rather than put them on a stretcher. You have to give report to another doctor. Another doctor has to accept them. The place you're sending them has to have the services they need. I mean, this was foundational to the idea of emergency medicine being a specialty and a practice that people could depend on. You know, before 1973, emergency departments were staffed by regular doctors who just moonlighted. You know, through the 70s and early 80s, you could depend that the ER started to be a place that the person that you were going to see could care for you no matter what you presented with. And then EMTALA really solidified that idea that no matter who you were, no matter, you know, if you had insurance or if you could pay, if you showed up to an ER in an emergency, that physician had the ability to take care of you with the best knowledge that they have. And that's what EMTALA was passed to do, and that's exactly what's on the line with this case in front of the court.
Derek, can you just tell us, is it true that if you don't provide the stabilizing care required under EMTALA, you as a physician are on the hook for fines? The hospital itself is on the hook. So it's not like this is a recreational act. You actually, there's a mandate and fines if you don't provide stabilizing care, correct?
Yes. So EMTALA is actually a complaint-driven process. So what happens is if somebody violates EMTALA, any American, any person can actually register a complaint through CMS. It actually goes through your state. And then there's an investigation. And if the investigation finds that there's a violation, there's a financial penalty, usually onto the hospital, but also it could be onto the physician. And then after a repeated offense, the hospital is at risk of no longer being allowed to be a Medicare-serving facility. And that is a very big risk to hospitals that serve an enormous number of patients that are publicly funded through Medicare. So hospitals are very much uninterested in violating EMTALA. And I would argue that until now, many physicians thought of EMTALA, you know, because we do what we do so naturally, as a little bit of an extra burden or an unnecessary regulation, because of course we're going to take care of every patient every time, no matter their ability to pay. That's what we do in emergency medicine. And so what we're seeing now is actually EMTALA is not just a protection for patients, but it's also a protection for doctors to be able to do what they know how to do without the concern that their local legislators or their local attorney general would then say, actually, that wasn't what you were supposed to do. That was illegal care in our state, even though there was an emergency that you were trying to treat.
So you're caught between this pincer is what you're saying, right? You've got requirements under EMTALA that you have to be sort of looking over your shoulder. Am I doing this right? Am I doing this right? And then you've got requirements under state law. And we're going to talk about the gap between the two of them. And you're liable under that, too. So you're trying to finesse your way through these. And I guess the question I want to ask you is there a thing called like abortion care in emergency medicine? Like, is there an entire bucket of care that is immediately recognizable and acknowledgeable as these are all abortion cases?
We take care of people for the emergency they have in front of them. The medical term for a spontaneous miscarriage is actually a spontaneous abortion. We use the term abortion all the time in clinical medicine, having nothing to do with what people think of, which is elective terminations of pregnancy. And so what I would say is pregnancies end all the time in emergency medicine, in emergency departments, and in hospitals. Oftentimes, they end for reasons that we can't even predict. And so pregnancy loss is common. And what we're seeing here, unfortunately, is the intersection of what is best practices of medicine and criminal liability. And this is beyond EMTALA, but even the thing about EMTALA was at least there, you could have the protection that in a emergency, right? You could do the best for your patient because this federal statute existed even if a national protection for access to care does not. This federal statute existed to at least say, in an emergency, we got this. And that's what the federal government said. They said, at least we can give you this protection to do the right thing right now. And certain states like Idaho and Texas are like, actually, no.
So let's explain the definitions because there is a gap here. And it seems, I don't know, to a layperson, like it's complicated. But I think you're going to explain to me that actually it's quite a gap. So EMTALA requires that if an individual comes to a hospital and the hospital determines that they have an emergency medical condition, they must, quote, stabilize the condition. And then it defines the term emergency medical condition to include things that put a patient's health in serious jeopardy, threatens serious harm to a patient's bodily functions, any bodily organ, any part. And also includes mental health for purposes of this definition of what an emergency looks like. And can you just walk us through, before we get to Idaho's law, what range of things go into that kind of description of what an emergency is?
Yeah, so I think that it's actually much more simple in practice than it is on that list. And that's why the lists are, tend to be not helpful to doctors, right? So somebody comes to my emergency department and I immediately assess them for an emergency. That will be things like checking their vital signs. It will be making sure that if they're bleeding, they're not bleeding in a way that would threaten, you know, a need for transfusion immediately, or that it wouldn't increase the rate of bleeding. It would maybe things like if they are at risk for self-harm and I discharge them, are they at risk to harm themselves over the next 24 hours, right? Those are all within the kind of umbrella of EMTALA insofar as I have to make sure that when I see somebody immediately in an emergency department, I am making sure that they don't need an intervention right there that will prevent them from getting worse as best as I can. Like, again, we can't fix everything, but within the arsenal that we have, if you will, of options, of treatments, interventions, medications, you know, consultants, we do everything we can right there before anything else to make sure that they are okay for now. And we don't stop until they are as okay as we can make them. That's what EMTALA protects. And again, trying to parse out what's allowable treatment under that protection versus what is not allowable has never been done. Right? We have never seen legislators look at the idea of intervening to prevent harm to somebody as then limited in its practice, but not for medical knowledge, not for changes in safety and efficacy, but only because legislation has decided that that procedure is only allowable in certain circumstances. And I guess the way that I kind of say it is, yes, EMTALA protections are broader than the exception under the state law in Idaho. And what's really frustrating to hear lawyers argue about is this idea of life of the mother as being predictable. So I spend every day in an emergency room when I have patients in front of me who are not doing well, or even who have potential to not do well, trying to prevent that window of within the life of the mother, right? Within the 24 hours, somebody could unfortunately die. Having to wait until I'm in that window to intervene is dangerous for people. And there are cases that are coming out that show us that the risks of waiting until you're at the brink of death, even if you don't die, will have consequences to your life and future fertility and organs and a lot of other things. So it's not harmless to wait until the brink of death to intervene. And in emergency medicine, we've always known that. And that is literally the gray area we're fighting in right now.
We are going to take a short break now to hear from our sponsors. More now with Dr. Dara Kass. So I love this gentle doctorly correction that you're offering up, because I'm sitting here wanting to parse the space between organ damage and necessary to prevent the death of the pregnant woman. That's the Idaho language. And you're like, Dalia, parsing words is not my job. It's your job. My job is, if somebody is going septic or at risk of a heart attack, I don't wait till they're having a heart attack. That's what you're telling me.
I mean, we've seen this. Everyone here who's listening has done this. They've gone to the ER with chest pain, right? They are not having a heart attack. Often they still see the cardiologist. They still go to the cardiac cath lab to figure out if they are at risk of a heart attack. We intervene early to make sure they don't have that heart attack, right? If we only could wait until heart attacks happen to fix people's clots in their heart, people would do worse. And in pregnancy, there's a really good example, I think, or really descriptive example, I should say, that makes a lot of sense to people. And we've seen articles about it in the popular press, and it's ectopic pregnancy. So you don't have to know a lot about the kind of weeds of how we treat and diagnose ectopic pregnancy. But what people, I think, understand is that from the time you get pregnant to the time that I can see an ectopic pregnancy, which is a pregnancy outside of the uterus, right in the wrong place, on ultrasound, and I can see what would be a fetal pole or what would be a forming, you know, embryo in the wrong place and sometimes with a heartbeat, there's a timeline that there are different pieces of information. It's a movie. And when I see you in the ER, I only get a snapshot. I get like a still image. When you come to an ER in a state that doesn't have restrictions on abortion access, or you're in a hospital that doesn't have any restrictions, I can offer you treatments earlier in that movie based on what you want. So for example, you're pregnant. Whether the pregnancy is desired or undesired is not relevant to the medical care we're talking about right now. You're pregnant. You don't have a pregnancy in the correct place. I don't see a pregnancy in your uterus. Your hormone levels are rising and you have abdominal pain. I can offer you the treatment, which would be to terminate this pregnancy medically, which means a shot. And we can follow your hormone levels down and then you can try to get pregnant again if that's what you want. Or I can wait until 24 hours, we can repeat your hormone levels and look again and see if the pregnancy is in the correct place or not in the correct place, and we can intervene. That waiting is not risk-free. That waiting means that I could find the pregnancy in the tube in the wrong place, but I could also find a heartbeat. And if I do, the treatment is different. The treatment is no longer a shot. The treatment is now surgery. And that surgery often removes your tube. And that changes your future fertility. And if you don't come back within 48 hours and you still have that embryo in the wrong place and you still are at risk, now you're at risk of what we call rupture. And many people have heard stories of people who have been sent home from the emergency department waiting for that evidence, that irrefutable, legally verifiable evidence that it is actually an ectopic pregnancy you're treating, that there is no doubt criminally that you could be charged for early ending what could potentially be a viable pregnancy. And doctors are feeling like they have to wait until that irrefutable evidence is in place rather than offering intervention earlier when we are 98% sure that it's going to end up in that place. And we're seeing cases of people having rupture of their tubes, losing tubes. I mean, the anxiety alone to know that you might have an ectopic pregnancy and they're not treating you today, but you have to come back in 2 days is something we never talk about. And there are harms. So I guess the point I'm trying to make to you is under EMTALA, the protection is to do what you need to do to stabilize somebody across all options you have. And yet we see all the time doctors changing their clinical practice to meet the legal mandates that they're living in. And we've never seen this before.
So now I'm going to follow up my annoying legal question with another, possibly more annoying legal question, Dara, and that is just up until Dobbs and states starting to pass these much more kind of constricted abortion laws, how did you make these EMTALA calls? Like until Dobbs, it was not a legal question, right? You just did your best judgment about what was required, yeah?
Yeah. You know, look, none of us can say that abortion access was accessible to all Americans before Dobbs. There were plenty of restrictions in place. But what we had were our foundational protections that in an emergency, you weren't going to go to jail. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. And no, physicians were not worried about being criminalized. Physicians weren't modifying their practice because a prosecutor would come after them for care that saved someone's life.
I keep reading about physicians. In fact, we've talked about this on the show with when we interviewed physicians around Dobbs and this question of, you know, so I'm in Arizona this week and now I'm facing 2 to 5 years in jail if I give someone an abortion for any reason other than saving the life of the mother. And always this kind of question of, what do? Do you stay? Do you leave? Do you just like pack up and go so that absolutely nobody in a state that has these very, very restrictive laws will get abortion care? And one of the things that I have read that I'd love for you to reflect on, Dara, is that EMTALA was kind of a backstop against that, right? You didn't have to agonize about which side of the line you're on. You can stay in a state. That was the purpose, in some sense, when the Biden administration clarified EMTALA, was to say, we're not going to fight whether this is, you know, the molar pregnancy or an ectopic pregnancy, or, you know, we're just going to let you provide stabilizing care. So for folks who are sort of on the fence about, do I continue to stay and practice medicine, if you eviscerate EMTALA, you're taking away a reason for people to stay in abortion deserts, right?
You're also taking away the ability for people to travel to abortion deserts. Like, I would even go further to say that if I am traveling to Idaho right now and I have an emergency in the state as a non-voting citizen of Idaho, I am at risk if I go to their emergency department of getting different levels of care than I would be if I was traveling anywhere else. I think it is a very complicated time to be a physician in the United States, or I would say a practitioner at all, right? Because there are also nurses and physician assistants. There's a lot of complication around practice of medicine right now in this space. And at our core, we want to do the right thing, right? So physicians and people who deliver healthcare, they don't go into the practice of medicine to not deliver healthcare, right? To be limited in our options. And so seeing what's happening with physicians who are staying in states like Idaho or Tennessee or Texas or anywhere that's restricting care right now, and now Arizona, you know, they feel committed to stay there. But you also have to remember that there are people who are thinking about their own families, their own children, right? Their own ability to get pregnant. So as patients, but also as parents who don't necessarily want to go to jail. I was giving a lecture yesterday in a room full of residents, and we're talking about caring for people. And every emergency physician I speak to is not confused about their mandate as a physician, right? I am here to take care of people. I will take care of anybody, anytime. And many people will say, come after me, right? I'm going to still do the right thing. I challenge you to challenge me. And I say to them, and what about if they put you in jail? Right? What happens to your children if you're now having to deal with the legal consequences of being a defendant in a criminalization trial? And we've seen certain attorneys general, like Indiana comes to mind with Dr. Caitlin Bernard, who delivered, you know, really life-saving care to an exception, to a patient who met the exception of her state. And the attorney general of her state came after her and her medical license as a vendetta. And she incurred hundreds of thousands of dollars in costs to defend herself and her name, and was very publicly shamed and threatened. The risks are not small to practice medicine in these environments right now.
She's the physician who provided abortion care to a teenage victim of incest and rape, right?
She was a preteen. She was 10 years old.
Yep. I want to ask you one question, because one of the claims in the state briefing is that EMTALA requires hospitals to offer stabilizing care to the unborn child. And so what they're saying is, if there's a medical emergency that endangers the fetus's life, that means that EMTALA is kind of at war with itself, right? Because it includes a mandate that you have to protect fetal life. Can you talk about both that argument, but also just what this creeping notion of embryonic children, fetal personhood, what that does to the practice of emergency medicine?
Yeah, so I think this is a really, really important point that is not being discussed enough. So the bottom line is this: EMTALA's End Labor Act part was about active labor. It was about the protection of a baby being born, right? I said before that certain people were coming to hospitals, they hadn't had no prenatal care, they were in labor. And the private hospital was saying, you're going to deliver at the public hospital. And they transferred them in active labor. Every person that comes to an emergency department in active labor, I have to check to make sure that they are not going to deliver literally in the elevator up to labor and delivery. Okay. So I want to frame out why this was included in EMTALA and what part of pregnancy we were talking about, right? Active labor, delivery of a fully gestated person who's coming out of the womb, viable, end of pregnancy. That is not the same as a life-threatening emergency for a pregnant person pre-viability, which is what these cases are. And we have a very specific practice in emergency medicine. To save the baby, you save the life of the mother. Like, you save the mother, right? We very clearly say in a trauma, right? If somebody is pregnant and they're 16 weeks pregnant, you save the mother. That is how you save the pregnancy, okay? It's always been our practice. If in certain circumstances the mother can't survive and the pregnancy is past viability, we would do an emergency C-section. We would deliver that baby as fast as we can past a certain gestational limit, right? There are already protections in place to prioritize the life of the unborn, if you will, that are viable in an emergency. What Idaho is infusing into this and what non-physicians or people that want to create circumstances that don't exist are saying is, actually, we're going to prioritize the 7-week embryo over the mother who's hemorrhaging. Because in some world that I have never been in all of my practice of emergency medicine, this law says prioritizing a 7-week embryo will do something for the viability and future of that embryo. There is no future for that embryo if the mother is not alive. And it's an absurd premise to say that there's actually a conflict existing in EMTALA. And we're going to hear a lot, I think, in these oral arguments about that possibility. And it isn't real. It just isn't.
So one of the things we've been talking about post-Dobbs, Dara, is how the confusion is the point, right? How sort of fomenting widespread, you know, chilling of services, uncertainty is the point, because, you know, you want physicians to be afraid. You want the hospital to be terrified. And I think Texas is a really good example. You referenced it already, of a state with exceptions to abortion laws that nobody understands, physicians can't interpret. We had Amanda Zarosky from Texas on the show, who described what happened, you know, as she developed sepsis and she may or may not be able to have future children. The design of this is that women with life-threatening conditions are just going to be turned away and told to come back because everybody is afraid. If Idaho wins, if Texas wins, and states get to dictate, I know you were sort of flicking at this with your answer to the last question, states get to dictate the standard of emergency room care, what does that look like?
It looks like chaos, which is kind of what we're seeing now. People expect, and rightfully, that when they show up to an emergency department, I and my colleagues will do everything we can to address their emergency right there and then. What this does is stops that from being true. It is literally that simple. And since EMTALA was passed, and again, it's what we had taken for granted as physicians, and I think many patients, right? 1986 is a long time ago. I'm not going to say how old I was because you'll be mad, but it's my entire life, basically. And so this protection has existed much like, you know, Roe before it. It is our whole grown up existence of going to emergency departments is the expectation that we will get the care we need when we show up. And that is true beyond emergency departments, right? So I think that EMTALA is a very small piece of this larger puzzle, which is that all of these restrictions, these state-by-state bans, these changes in the standard of care are requiring that doctors deliver worse care to their patients, and not because they want to. And in the Amanda Zarofsky case, one of the things that their case right now in front of the Texas Supreme Court is literally about the fact that their physicians couldn't do what they knew how to do because the state was confusing and they're asking for clarifications on the restrictions. And the state of Texas, with a straight face, as all of these attorneys do, says, actually, your doctors are wrong. You should sue your doctors, right? Who says that they don't know what to do? They're the ones that are at fault, right? And everywhere we turn, it's like, it's dizzying. The attorneys general will blame the doctors. They'll blame the patients. They'll blame the health system. They'll blame everybody for the care being worse because the laws that they are creating are causing worse care. They're causing detrimental outcomes. They're causing women to have to be septic or rupture their tubes because they're ectopic. Or again, the thing we don't talk about enough is that we're discharging people who know they have a ticking time bomb in their body. And we're saying to them, how you feel doesn't matter. The fact that you know your pregnancy is going to end next week is not important to us, because our attorney general says you have to sit and suffer for another week pregnant, waiting to end this pregnancy for what is medically no reason. And that is, I think, what kills me the most, because I have had to discharge those patients for other reasons with other things that I couldn't treat. And looking somebody in the eye and saying, I know what to do, but can't do it today, is gut-wrenching. And this is just, it's just wholly unnecessary.
I want to give you a chance before we say goodbye to talk about the mifepristone argument, because you wrote, I thought, a really smart piece in Slate after Aaron Hawley, who was arguing for the Miffy ban, went further than they had gone, even in the briefing, and started insisting that her clients, these objecting physicians, couldn't deliver standard miscarriage care because of the possibility that the patient, unbeknownst to that physician, had taken abortion medication before coming to the ER. And that possibility, that the sort of causal chain here requires the physician to know how this miscarriage is happening, I think kind of blew your mind.
I think that's exactly what I said. Look, let's pause for a second and acknowledge that both cases in front of the Supreme Court are arguing about emergency care. And in a world where anti-abortion advocates are talking about abortion not being healthcare, it is ironic that the cases they're bringing to the court to restrict access for all Americans are about emergencies. And how is it that if it's not healthcare, the only place you can get to take in front of the Supreme Court is the emergency care of a patient who is at risk of harm? All right. So I want to just kind of put a pin in that. So when Aaron Hawley kind of went into the lane of emergency medicine, and more specifically into the ambiguity of caring for somebody that her clients may ethically disagree with, I both laughed and got frustrated, and rage is what really spilled over, because I take care of patients all the time who make decisions who I don't agree with, right? I take care of children in my house every day who make decisions about things I don't agree with, you know? And the idea that they should have to remove a medication that is safe and effective and does what it's supposed to do because her clients can't tell if they took that medication, and so therefore it needs to be removed from the market to protect her clients, is just, it's absurd on its face, and it needs to be called out. The whole kind of spectrum of this conversation is as simple as all of these efforts to restrict access to abortion in the United States are harming people. And they are harming people without any care of who they harm for a goal that has nothing to do with healthcare. It has nothing to do with families. It has nothing to do with viability or life. It is causing women to become infertile. It is causing pregnancies to end and people not being able to get pregnant again. It is causing emotional trauma and harm. Women are forced to carry pregnancies to term that they know are not going to end up in successful, you know, children and children that they can raise. And they're not being given the option to heal. And that compounded harm on a generation of people who can get pregnant and their families is something we're going to look back on, I think, in 50 years and just say, how did we let this happen? But how did we not cut it off as fast as we could at every single place we can? And these cases in front of the court are exactly that opportunity to say, no, this is too far. This has to stop. We cannot change the standard of care in an emergency for every patient that comes into an emergency department, because you hate the idea that some people might want to end their pregnancies because of reasons that are none of your business.
Dr. Derek Kass is an emergency medicine physician in New York. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times and the Washington Post, as well as multiple publications for healthcare professionals. And until very, very recently, she served as a regional director at the U.S. Department of HHS based in New York City. Dara, it is always, I always learn so much talking to you, and more even than that, I always learn how much I don't freaking know from talking to you. So thank you so much for being here and making the stakes here absolutely crystal clear.
Well, I will say that having you in my life has helped a world where we have to all become lawyers and doctors all at the same time. So thank you.
We're taking a break now, but when we come back, Slate's very own Mark Joseph Stern will join me to talk about all the talk about Justice Sonia Sotomayor's retirement date. So So we want to turn for a second to another issue that has been hopping, at least on Twitter, this week. What started with a trickle of think pieces has now suddenly become a cascade of DC press releases, talking heads opining, and full-on should she, shouldn't she from liberal advocacy groups on the matter of whether Justice Sonia Sotomayor is duty-bound to step down now before the election. Now, this cajoling and smoke signaling is by its very nature a little hinky, a little unseemly. Some would suggest, I think me among them, it also just comes across as deeply sexist. But it is also way too late in this conservative takeover of the court system to duck these awkward conversations because of feelings. So we're going to talk now to Mark Joseph Stern about what you should think and feel about this matter as Mark Joseph Stern and I mull over what we think we should think about this matter. So, Mark, welcome back to the main show. Let's talk a little bit about Sonia Sotomayor.
Big sigh. Hi, Dahlia.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I almost want to start with that awkward feelings question, which is every public event I have done since the illness of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, at some point someone has stood up and said, this is all her fault, and I hate it. I hate this conversation with the heat of a million suns. Yourself?
I dislike the conversation, but also want to respect people's anger because I think that they have, on some level, a right to feel frustration. I think sometimes that frustration is misdirected. I totally understand why they see Justice Ginsburg's death at the end of the Trump administration and sort of pinpoint her for the blame. At the same time, I think that it helps to step back and look at how we got to a point where RBG's death could lead to a 6-3 conservative supermajority, right? Only through the unprecedented obstruction of Merrick Garland's nomination, and then through the rushed, hardball, totally hypocritical confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett in 2020, as people were literally voting, all done by Republicans, masterminded by Mitch McConnell, only through that chain of events was the court truly and fully flipped to this entrenched dominant majority, where the conservatives could always lose one vote and still reign supreme, as we saw in Dobbs and so many other disastrous decisions. And so I'll just be honest, I feel some frustration with Justice Ginsburg. I think that she made the decision in 2013 or 2014 that Hillary Clinton was going to win in 2016 and that she wanted to step down under the first woman president and be replaced by the first woman president, and that she overestimated Hillary's potential to win and maybe also overestimated her own health at the time. But I also think that, first of all, she shouldn't have been in that position in the first place, where perhaps the entire fate of all democracy and civil rights rested on her retirement timing. This is more broadly a systems problem, that we have an incredibly bizarro, messed up system where individual mortality of a handful of lawyers determines the fate of the republic. And I would just love for people who are understandably frustrated with Justice Ginsburg, and now I think transferring some of that frustration to Justice Sotomayor, which we'll talk about, I would love for them to also take a step back and think about this broader, deeply messed up process by which we replace justices, which it turns out is super easy to game if you're just cynical enough about it and ruthless enough. And Mitch McConnell was, and Democrats simply weren't. And I don't know if that's like a good thing or a bad thing. I don't think you can apply normative labels. All you can say is that Mitch McConnell decided that he was going to use the most extreme kind of hardball with the courts imaginable to violate and shatter every known norm on the books in order to keep Democrats from appointing justices and to ensure that Republicans could. And that needs to play a role in this conversation, both about RBG and about Justice Sotomayor, because if you aren't talking about that, you are missing the full picture.
Yeah, I think my one systems response, which I invariably trot out to the fury of whoever's yelling at me in the audience, is that a version of what you just said, which is Mitch McConnell held a seat open for almost a year, and we did nothing. You know, we bellyached and we groused. We did nothing. And then we went into an election in 2016 that we knew was going to be a close election. I don't know if Justice Ginsburg thought it was going to be a rout. I certainly didn't. And we had one open seat that had been held open. We had two octogenarians and one soon-to-be octogenarian on the court. And one side voted as though that was true, and one side didn't. And one side campaigned as though that was true, right? We had Ted Cruz, we had John McCain running for office saying, to be clear, if I win my Senate seat back, we will hold that seat open for 4 more years or 8 more years if Hillary wins. They were very clear.
Even McCain. John McCain, moderate McCain, said, if Hillary wins and we get the Senate, we're holding open Scalia's seat because that belongs to a conservative.
And meanwhile, all due respect, we had a bunch of Democrats running for the Senate. Crickets. Nothing. Nobody ran on it. Nobody messaged it. And I want to make one other point, because this is my great man theory of politics. We talked about this last week with Juliette. It's so fun to blame one person in hindsight. But to the extent that you use it to absolve yourself of responsibility and thus absolve yourself of learning the lesson, right? Which is that by a 2-to-1 margin, every single voter in 2016 who showed up to vote about the court voted for Donald Trump. We didn't care. We rank it number 13. So I think we've learned that it is an issue. But I just want to be really, really clear that that transposing of we failed to make it an issue, we failed to vote on it as though, and I don't mean I'm going to get we. Democrats in general failed to make it an issue, to run on it as an issue, to message it as an issue, and then lost the court. And it is well and good to be mad at RBG, but to keep replicating that we're going to vote someone off the island every election cycle because we haven't learned the lesson that you can pack the court, you can do term limits, you can do court expansion, you can do jurisdiction stripping. There are things you can do, systemic things, to change the fact that we live in a monarchy in which we wait for smoke signals to see which of the Dauphin, you know, like it's insane that we live this way under this system, and there's one side that is completely willing to subvert the system and the other side that likes to yell at justices, and here is where I say parenthetically, really likes to yell at the female justices.
So I guess I would just push back on that last point, if I may, because I don't think that anyone has faced as fierce a push for retirement as Justice Stephen Breyer. And I will just agree that much of the grousing and screaming at the female justices has shades of sexism in it. I don't disagree at all that some of the demands made of Justice Ginsburg 10 years ago and Justice Sotomayor today have shades of some kind of misogynistic or patriarchal, like, assumptions about a woman's ability to make judgments for herself. I'm not contesting that. But I will say again that the groups, capital G, all of the progressive groups that are like really kind of realistic about the courts and pushing to get the Democratic Party and progressives to be more realistic and hardball-y about the courts, they screamed at Stephen Breyer. They screamed at him. They drove around trucks with signs saying, retire Stephen Breyer. They pummeled the media with commentary and analysis and hits on TV saying, it is time for him to step down. Democrats got around to it. It wasn't as, I think, as blatant as some of the groups would have liked, but we did see some Democratic office holders saying, you know, it would be great to be able to replace him now. There was a startlingly vigorous push to get Steve Breyer to retire, and he did it. And frankly, I think we all know that he didn't really love doing it. He did not want to step down. He loved that job. He wanted to keep it, but he made the calculation that it was time. And I think there is a real chance, we'll never know unless we read his diary, and I do not want to read his diary ever, but I think that there's a chance that some of this harassment, that he took it into account, that it played a role, and that helped coax him off the court. And because of that, we got Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, a relatively young Black woman who is doing amazing stuff on that court today. And so, you know, just to sort of swing it back to where we are right now with Justice Sotomayor, you and I think that she is the cat's pajamas, because she is. She is a brilliant jurist. She brings so much to the bench. Her perspective as a Latina, her life experience, her inspiring story, her views on criminal justice are so crucial. Her understanding of systemic racism. I could go on and on. But there are other amazing judges in the wings who are waiting for an elevation. There are other awesome Biden appointees who are waiting to get tapped for a seat on the Supreme Court. They aren't auditioning like Trump's people on the Fifth Circuit. They aren't doing like a Jim Ho or a Don Willett, but they are really brilliant, awesome people, including Latinas, who could fill that seat admirably and nobly and do amazing work and also be 47 years old while doing it. And Justice Sotomayor is approaching 70. She does have health problems. I'm not going to pretend to know the severity of those health problems. I'm not going to say that they alone are a reason for her to step down. But she's reached an age where most Americans are already retired. She served on the court for 15 years. I myself have been saying for quite a long time that we should not expect justices to serve for decades, that it's a bit arrogant for them to cling on to power for that long and assume that the nation simply needs them to. I'm not saying that Justice Sotomayor is arrogant. I'm not applying that to her at all. But I do think that if we lose sight of all of these other amazing replacements who could sit in that seat and also be 30 years younger, that progressives are not playing the game with the same amount of vigor or realism as conservatives do.
So I think let's talk for a minute about what we agree about and what we disagree about. I think we agree that ultimately this is a systems problem, that we should not live in thrall to nine justices appointed for life, who, by the way, give us no information, right? Remember when Clarence Thomas was in the hospital and nobody told us why or for how long? Remember when Chief Justice Rehnquist was dying of thyroid cancer and would miss arguments and no one would tell us why? Part of the problem is there's a, in other branches of normal government, functioning, transparent government, there's a duty to disclose catastrophic health outcomes, and people can plan their lives around it, and one can plan whether or not to then rally to push someone off the court. We live under this insane system in which the ways we talk about the court and to the court are in these like hushed tones of acolytes, right, at Delphi, and we don't know anything. We're not told anything. I just want to reference, this is going to seem slightly orthogonal, but there was a great piece in Slate this week by Sam Buell and Daryl Miller about how the story of January 6th needs to be told at the court when the immunity arguments happen. And it's again, I think, raises this question of why are we not allowed to talk to the court the way we talk to other bodies of government? Like, why are we going to have to go into the Supreme Court in that case and just make arcane arguments about, you know, zones of presidential authority rather than saying at the Supreme Court, hey, y'all, he insurrected. So I think this is part of just a larger conversation about who gets to talk to the justices and how we are allowed to speak to them. And I think that that is a systems problem. And the other thing I just agree with absolutely fundamentally, Mark, is that when you are in thrall to nine monarchs, you absolutely do not have, I think, any of the levers to do anything in a normal way, right? And so then you're just like, someone should sell someone to tell Justice Sotomayor that maybe none of her clerks have told her to retire. And this is not a healthy way to have, right, public conversation. I agree with you on that. I want to make one more point just about the gender stuff, because I think actually this is where you and I may disagree. And stipulated, I think that the effort to force Justice Breyer off the court was, as you said, forceful and aggressive. But I just want to point out that virtually every person, Nate Silver, Josh Barrow, Mehdi Hasan, the people who are, you know, now we're hearing it from Senator Dick Blumenthal, virtually every person pushing is male. And the people defending are female. That seems to be the breakdown. So to suggest that there isn't really a gender valence at work here, I think isn't quite right. And the only other thing I want to add, because this has been chomping on my butt for a couple of months, is that just as women have this second shift, quote unquote, where after doing their day job, they then go home and do all the dishes and refill the soap dispensers, like it or not, that still exists, right? There's data to that. I think there is a profound second shift for the women at the court, which is protecting the reputational interests and the integrity of the court. It is not an accident that it's Sotomayor and Justice Barrett going around the country saying, we're friends, we're fine. It is not an accident that it's the women who are following the disclosure rules and the ethics rules, and the men are just like, eh, I'm cool. I don't have to do anything. It is not an accident that that breakdown in Anderson was women versus men, because there is a second shift that is happening at the U.S. Supreme Court that is protecting the reputational interests of that court. And in my view, it falls most heavily on, yes, it falls on the chief, but it falls very heavily on the women justices, and the people who just don't care overwhelmingly tend to be men. So the very last thing I want to say about this, because it kind of bugs me, is that these pleas that Sonia Sotomayor has an extra responsibility because she's the people's justice and she's so solicitous for how real people and real lives are lived, is kind of a way of piling on guilt to a person who has lived her life without doubt, triangulating against the public and the interests of the court and not her own interests. End of sermon. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
So I think that's a great place, Dahlia, now to turn toward what Sotomayor might be thinking, because I totally agree with you that she is obviously a smart person, also a tactical person, a person who is more than capable of thinking through her position right now and her options and which is best for the causes that she cares about and for the country that she serves. I think that Justice Sotomayor is considerably more tactical and realist-minded than Justice Ginsburg was. I think that RBG was kind of a starry-eyed lover of American democracy in a really beautiful way, and also a lover of the Supreme Court, and a lover of opera with Justice Scalia, going on foreign trips to India, going with Rehnquist and O'Connor on these fun junkets to talk to other courts. She really believed in the court and seemed to believe in it as an institution that sits above politics, which is wonderful in many ways. And there was a period when I think she brought that perspective in a helpful way, because people like Anthony Kennedy felt they could work with her and be like, this is not a political operative. We're working toward these ideals. And, you know, sometimes I think she would shame Tony Kennedy into voting the right way because she just managed to bring him around to views about like individual rights and the court's position in a constitutional republic to step in and protect things like reproductive autonomy and marriage equality. I think that Justice Sotomayor talks that talk. I'm not sure that she really believes it. So you mentioned Justice Sotomayor going on these talking trips with Justice Amy Coney Barrett, where they sit and chat about how they're all best friends and they all get along so well and they love having lunch. The lunches, Dahlia, the lunches, they're so glorious, and they just talk about their books and their children and their passions. And okay, and I think it's great for Justice Sotomayor to do that and to keep this friendship with Justice Barrett and make her feel welcome in the fold and not alienate her and push her away, like, say, Justice Scalia famously did with O'Connor, right? But at the same time, I think that Justice Sotomayor is super clear-eyed about the dangers of a 6-3 court, and also understands the potential perils of a 7-2 court. She gets that a 7-2 court would mean the end of everything she cares about, right? Of marriage equality, of any kind of gender equality that remains under the law, of congressional power to enforce voting rights and, you know, to regulate all these important industries, to basically maintain the post-New Deal America that the Supreme Court allowed in the 1930s after that great fight with FDR. She understands that a 7-2 court would fully rewind the clock to a point when the Supreme Court was regularly striking down child labor laws and holding that women had no equal citizenship. She gets all of that. You know, there's a great opinion from a recent term where she complained about the newly constituted court overturning precedent, specifically calling out Justice Barrett, Justice Kavanaugh for joining and immediately overturning precedent. She did this in the opinions over SB 8 in Texas. She did this in cases where the new justices simply joined and shredded any past decisions they didn't care about. Justice Ginsburg didn't do that. RBG really did treat the court more sacrosanct than I think Justice Sotomayor does. And that's important when we're talking about her possible retirement, because we have to acknowledge, I think, that she is aware of the stakes. She is aware of the threats. She knows how utterly catastrophic a 7-2 court would be, because she knows how catastrophic a 6-3 court is, because she writes about it. And she calls out her conservative colleagues for inflicting horrible damage on the law and individual rights in the country. And so I think at the end of the day, I feel more trust in Justice Sotomayor to make the right decision than many of the critics on the left and center who are now calling her out and pushing for her retirement. But I would be remiss if I didn't say I do think she should seriously consider retiring, because I think that she has served the country well for a long time. I think there are brilliant jurists waiting in the wings who could replace her. And I think that the stakes are just too sky high to gamble on Trump winning a second term, Republicans winning the Senate, her having to step down or, God forbid, dying, and the court flipping to a far right majority that it would probably take 50 years to unshake.
I don't disagree with anything you just said. I also fundamentally agree with the fact that I think Justice Sotomayor is one of the savviest understanders of what's really going on at the court, which is what makes it doubly funny that people keep writing her these funny coded notes. I guess I would also just say so many of these problems would have been solved with adding 4 seats to the court, doing away with term limits, or other hardball tactics that we don't ever want to talk about, except here on this show. Last question for you, Mark. We are working on a little project about a little something we like to call originalism. It's going to be print, it's going to be podcast, and it's going to have a live show. Capstone live show on May 14th at 6th and I in Washington, D.C. All of those of you who came to last year's live show know that it was the best event of the end of court season. Mark, do you want to talk a little bit about what it is that we are going to be doing in our Originalismapalooza?
We are going to be talking about how originalism is both a trick and a trap. About how originalism is a bogus way of doing the law, that it's practiced in a bogus manner by bogus judges. Well, they're real judges, but we think that they're kind of bogus. And we will be then talking about how even if originalism were feasible and practicable, that it would be a horrible way of doing the law, because it would anchor all of our rights and liberties to the views of long dead white slaveholding men who didn't think that any of us should have any rights at all. And it's going to be really fun. We're going to have fun doing it. And everyone should come before we sell out, because we may well sell out. And last year's truly was the best. And you probably know a lot about originalism if you listen to this show and Dahlia educates you, but there is more to learn. And we are interviewing some of the top minds for this show and going to have some amazing guests on stage with us. So get your tickets, come see us, have a drink with us. It's going to be a blast.
So there it is, May 14th, 6th and I in Washington, D.C. If you want to beat the rush, go to slate.com/amicuslive for more details and to get your tickets. And we really look forward to seeing you out there. And as Mark says, if you haven't given a ton of thought to not just why we live with originalism, but like, oh my God, how much longer can we live with originalism? This is going to be a very, very, I think, deeply reported and hopefully kind of groundbreaking way to think about getting ourselves out of this trap. Mark Joseph Stern, thank you so much. Mark covers the courts and the law and all the things and the Sonia Sotomayor Retirement Watch beat for us at Slate.com. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Dahlia.
Before we go, Slate Plus members, it is week 2 of your upgraded subscriber benefits, and another weekly bonus episode is coming your way. These brand new bonus episodes are home for all the extra stuff we cannot fit into the main show, and it's also where you can access our emergency podcasts that we do during Opinion Palooza. Of course, you'll be able to continue to listen to this show and all your other favorite Slate podcasts ad-free. The new standalone bonus episodes are just the cherry on top, and they help more people find and access our subscriber content, and that helps us to keep the studio lights on. And for that, we thank you. It is very hard to do this work in the dark. On this week's Amicus Plus episode, Mark Stern and I are tackling the horrifying and yet completely predictable Arizona Supreme Court decision to bring back a zombie abortion ban from not the last century, but the one before that. You can listen right now by joining Slate Plus. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts by clicking Try Free at the top of our show page, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. The episode is available for you to listen to right now, and we'll see you there. And that is a wrap for this episode of Amicus. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for your letters and your questions and your comments. You can always keep in touch at amicus@slate.com, or you can find us at facebook.com/amicuspodcast. Do not forget to buy your tickets for our live show happening in Washington, D.C., May 14th at 6 and I. Go to slate.com/amicuslive to snag your tickets and to get more details. And we'll pop a link into the show notes, and we will see you there. Sarah Birmingham is Amicus's senior producer. Our producer is Patrick Fort. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio at Slate. Susan Matthews is Slate's executive editor. And Ben Richmond is our senior director of operations. We will be back with another episode of Amicus next week. And until then, hang on in there.